Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tasha Chaparis. Joining me on the show this week is Cindy Crane, President and CEO of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance. Also, we have Sam Merton, COO of The Bridge, and Michael Sidarzeski, President of the Cedars Neighborhood Association. Today, we'll discuss the latest in the plan to close Tent City, the massive homeless encampment under Interstate 45 outside of downtown. Let's get started. So Tent City has become the largest homeless encampment ever seen in Dallas. More than 200 people live under the I-45 overpass near Malcolm X Boulevard. It's a village of tents with distinct neighborhoods, but it's also dangerous to the people living there. Two people have been killed there this year, prompting many to demand Tent City be closed. City Council met yesterday to discuss what happens next, and it seems everyone agrees the encampment needs to be closed, but not everyone agrees on what should be done. So, Michael, you live nearby and work downtown, and you're among the people who want to see Tent City gone. Why do you want that, and what do you hope happens next?
I mean, that's a pretty obvious answer, right? It's the crime. It's the ecosystem that is around Tent City. So if you live down there, you hear sirens all the time, and a lot of those sirens are always directed towards Tent City and its other ilk. So we have those behind Heritage Village as well. So there's a safety concern. There's a well-being for the citizens concern too. So I think a lot of the conversation revolves around homeless and kind of disassociating them as citizens of City of Dallas. So we need to take care of them as well. If you look at the region, not just the zip code and not just the breakdown of the neighborhood, the Cedars specifically, but if you jump across I-45, you've got Austin Street and a whole bunch of homeless services there. To be clear, and as a point of interest, there are tents popped up all over the city, right? But if you look at the region of care, it is focused around the bridge and it's focused around south of I-30. And that's the concern that we have. It's not that there are only homeless people downtown. There are homeless people all over the city. But the majority of the concentration of services is downtown.
So, Cindy, you've been going out there a lot, out to Tent City, I mean, mm-hmm. and taking caseworkers and trying to work to get some of these people housed. Can you explain mm-hmm. a little bit about what you have been doing and how that's mm-hmm. working into closing Tent City?
You know, when you look at trying to close a large encampment area, you've kind of got two basic things. One, take care of the poverty, take care of the people who are experiencing the poverty. And the other side is securing and controlling the site of the poverty. And so in this initiative, myself, representing the homeless service provider, we've really taken up the task of dealing with the poverty through direct, consistent, and persistent case management. So the peak of the daytime count was about 251, and that was about in February of the daytime count. So when I counted Monday, we counted 215 tents, not people. We know some tents are storage, and some tents have probably more than one person that may stay there at night. So over the course of that time, we have a team of case managers going out. We have 227 case files, literally assessments, what we call standardized intake, looking at and also establishing what their severity of service needs is. Just a basic concept, best practice, go in there, get a by name list of everyone's there, and start working through those that are the most vulnerable. And so that is a process that we've been going through we've been doing it since last fall, but the population grew dramatically over the winter. And so we knew we had to do a lot more than just one day a week. So we have directly housed 26 people. We think we have about another 25 that'll be gone by May, and we're working with others to help them figure out their own housing plan.
But that still leaves about 150 yeah. people behind. So what happens mm-hmm. to them?
Oh, absolutely. So the case files also is to get contact information, try to get some people, even phones, figure out where they're going to be. Because when you close down a tent city, you're not ending unsheltered homelessness. You're trying to focus on closing down a site that is too large, too out of control, too dangerous, and too dangerous to public health, and too dangerous for the people who are residing there. So a couple of things is we know some people are not going to go into shelter, but we still need to, that we need to identify emergency shelter sites. And that's part of the presentation that happened at City Council yesterday. What we know from talking to folks at San Francisco and New Orleans on our conference call was that we think there's 156 that we can't directly house, but we will see with the continual as we get closer to the hour, like most people wait to the last minute. I think there will be far fewer than 156 there. People need that antagonistic pressure really to get them to make some decisions that right now they're afraid to make.
So, Sam, can you explain what the proposal is from the bridge. I mean, you all went before city council yesterday and said that you needed some money to help expand capacity. Can you explain that?
So we internally hosted the City of Dallas, including the Housing Department, Dallas Fire Rescue, and the City Attorney's Office to evaluate our facility and our ability to expand shelter to make sure that these folks have a place to go. You know, I think one of the many things Michael and I and a lot of the neighborhood folks agree on is it's not acceptable to evacuate Tent City without some place to tell them that they're able to go. Wanted to work on a solution to that. So we looked internally. We determined that we could add another 50 beds to our capacity. And then we started reaching out to our partner shelters. We partner with the other four major shelters in the city, Austin Street, Dallas Life, Salvation Army, Union Gospel Mission. Just reached out to them and said, hey, you know, what can you do along with us to create some capacity on a short-term basis for these folks so that, again, we can give them that opportunity. I think it's going to be a lot more of a contentious situation if we are telling the residents there that they have to leave, but we're not offering them a place to go. And so we're just really dedicated on making sure that that's available for them. And so our proposal is for 240 beds, which is what we were able to kind of get our partners to lean into. And then we asked the council, the Dallas City Council, to fund half of that, the costs associated with that. And we have committed, the bridge has committed, even though we're not housing the majority of the folks, we've committed to raising that other half through private donations and state and county money as well.
So yesterday you asked for $500,000 for the rest of this year. Right?
Yes.
So there seemed to be some confusion about why that money is necessary. The bridge has a public-private partnership with the city.
Yes.
But these other shelters are private. So can you explain what that cost is for? What does that cost cover? Because these other shelters aren't free to stay at, right?
Correct. And that's one of the major components is, you know, the biggest shelter opportunity that we have is Dallas Life Shelter, which does great work, and we partner with, you know, we see their folks every single day because, you know, they're a night shelter. But they have, I mean, they have more than 100 beds ready to go, you know, right now. It's just they have different criteria for acceptance, and they charge $10 a night to stay there. So there are a lot of folks, particularly folks like those living in Tent City, who can't afford the $10 and sometimes can't meet the barriers. You know, they may have a felony on their record that restricts them from staying there. So what we're doing with Dallas Life is kind of working out this agreement where they will modify some of their standards, again, on a short-term basis, and we will help, you know, provide funding to them to be able to accommodate their costs, because to your point, they're a private entity. So that's part of it. And then it's also going to increase, you know, our load of folks that we are putting through our recovery system, you know, because it doesn't make sense to just say, let's find these folks a place to stay without saying, let's give them the tools to recover from homelessness and eventually find housing. So, you know, our plan, part of the cost is the folks at Dallas Life, the folks at Salvation Army, much like we're serving their populations right now, every single day, we're feeding them lunch, we're feeding them breakfast, we're providing them recovery services. We would do that for that entire population.
So, Cindy, can you explain a little bit what the population of Tent City is like?
The mean age of homelessness in Dallas, we soon to be about 47, which is consistent across Texas and the southern region. But Tent City is a little older. The mean age was like 50.5. And I'm out there almost every day. And when we say that we're focusing on the most vulnerable, we're talking about those that are possess disabilities, chronic illnesses, documented disabilities. It is predominantly African-American. It has a larger female presence than a typical encampment area that you might see, which is maybe indicative of a lot of things and activities that were going on there. The preponderance of those individuals that present with chronic medical, what we call disabling conditions, multiple conditions, is the majority of the population that is staying there. That's different necessarily than the population that might pass through there, because we know there's criminal activity, we know there's drug activity. And so it is what we call in our world a very vulnerable population, vulnerable to exploitation, vulnerable to just not being needing assistance in making the highest best decisions, constantly under trauma, constantly under stress, constantly trying to figure out what they need to do to survive. And so because we may go out there during the day, at night it's a different set of rules. And so though they try to reach out to us and we try to help them make the best decisions, we're not certain what's influencing their decisions at night. And so that makes our work very challenging. But it's really not particularly, if you could maintain that communication of case management and thoughtful dialogue of what is your housing plan and how can I help you get there, if we had the capacity to do that at night, we'd have more success. That's why you hear the suggestions that if we could get them an emergency shelter, now you have a condition in the evening hours where you're not having to make the same compromises to protect your literal space, to protect your tent. So that's why getting folks to go to shelter must be part of what that closure plan is. In speaking with the case managers, I was at City Council yesterday, the staffing. We already were prepared, assuming that closure would be in May, that by mid-April, which starts next week, that we would bring in representatives from the emergency shelters. It's already a part of the plan that's in our war room wall to say, all right, you know, here's what our residents are telling us under I-45 of why they don't want to go to shelter. So let's problem solve this. What can we do? You can't make the shelter experience for I-45 different than the people who are already there, because there's an issue of fairness. There's an issue of you still want to make sure you're serving the people who are most vulnerable. So our primary task right now has been trying to get them housing outside of shelter, straight from street to housing. And we found another housing complex that's got some units. We found that about that yesterday afternoon. So we're hustling right now to see who is the highest best possibility to be housed in those. And we're working on getting some reduced tenant-based screening. So our goal is just to get it as low as possible, because that is the population. They have criminal backgrounds, multiple evictions, and have very small incomes. And we have to work with what we got to see if we can find them housing.
So one of the things that really struck me yesterday in the council briefing was that May date that has been talked about since February doesn't seem to be the hard deadline anymore. Why is that? It wants to be closed in May, right? But
yeah.
It's still not, there's not a date set for we're going to come in and we're going to push everyone out, right?
I don't have any communication that has indicated that we are moving away from the first week of May. Knowing best practices and reading all the literature from Org Code, from USIC, from NAEH, and all the other groups that provide national technical assistance and support to continued care in homeless communities, moving the date, in my opinion, and I'll clarify, that would probably be a mistake. No, we're not. If you think that we have to solve unsheltered homelessness by the first week of May, you'll never close it down. It is dangerous. The site's too big. I think that we are on the trajectory. And the most important target of our communication are the residents that live there. Changing the message to them, I don't think would be the wisest choice right now. I think we're all on that trajectory, including the clients. Moving, the antagonist state of moving, is an important part of our case management and getting them to the goal of deciding on a housing plan.
Okay, so come May, Tent City is gone, ideally, right? But there are other nearby encampments. Mm-hmm. So without additional shelter beds and nearby encampments, where do they go? I know, Michael, for your neighborhood, you're concerned that they're going to be in your area more and more.
It's no longer a concern. It's a fact. I mean, they're already there. Heritage Village is there. There are other tent populations popping up around the neighborhood already. So it used to be, it used to be that that was a concern, and looking at the timeline of Tent City when we first started talking about closing it and giving it a May date, that was a problem. I think the big question, though, is like when you start to approach a deadline like that, there's a lot of tension that grows. And from all of the service providers and all in the city and our neighborhood, certainly there's that tension that grows. But we've known that Tent City's growing for 2 years, right? And so this isn't a big surprise to anyone. The question the neighborhood has is, why are we waiting until now to like really dredge to the deepest canyons that we can to come up with solutions? Like, why did we wait so long? And it's not a blame. It's not like nobody can answer that question. It just happened the way it did. But we need to start treating this like an emergency instead of the casual conversations that I think we're having today, right? How do we treat this like a FEMA disaster? Because that's what it is. And it's not just a Dallas problem. It's not a Fort Worth problem. It's a nationwide problem. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be addressed like a federal emergency, in my opinion.
So what are the long-term solutions at this point?
First thing is, we know that not everyone's going to go into shelter or find housing on that date. And I think we've got some, we probably can also identify probably about 25 people who are going to have a housing solution. It's just not going to happen on May 4. And so we've got to figure out what would be their temporary. Obviously, those would be folks we'd really want to get into shelter because that kind of, you know, get that per diem rate and know that they have a housing solution. You have to have street outreach. And I've said it since I arrived here last year in Dallas, is that it's extraordinary for this urban area with this many unsheltered homeless that there is not professional case management that do street outreach. And street outreach is not easy. It's a very different animal. And we have, through this process, probably identified 4 people that are just top notch. But we probably need 10 to 12 more. This is a very large county, and to get in those spots and a good case street outreach case management, you know, the ratio is a 1 case manager to 10, and you work those cases until you close the deal and find them a housing option. And I have reiterated that. So I think when we talk about long-term solution, I know of 2 that are coming online the first week of May, right? When this closes down, some of these people have to go back to their jobs. And so I'm doing everything I can to say we have got to immediately create these positions and fund these positions. You need both the shelter, and for the people not in shelter, you know, we need to be out at Dallas Heritage Village. I've gotten to know several of the people out there, and if I had the time to be out there every day and pressing them, what's your housing plan? Let's figure this out. Let's get you back to your family, et cetera. All these different solutions you're trying to create and problem solve to help them find a solution. Because if they're not going to engage in the shelter where the core of the services are, then you've got to have an alternative. In what we say, you got to meet the client where they are. And right now, they're under the bridge.
And I think one of the biggest components is there just has to be a strong will of the council and other elected officials to really step up and fund permanent supportive housing. It's, you know, everybody, you know, talks a lot about the cottages that are coming on board, and there's a lot to like about that.
But that's only 50.
But it's only 50, and you know, there are questions about how cost effective that is at, you know, $140,000, $150,000 a unit. So I think we need to really, really catch up to other major cities. You know, if you look at what, you know, Boston, New York, Miami, they're coming up with innovative ways to create funding streams that are dedicated solely for affordable and permanent supportive housing. And while Dallas certainly hasn't completely sat on its hands on this issue, again, we're behind what other cities are doing. You know, inclusionary zoning is another big thing that we're seeing other cities have. You know, Boston is a great example of how they've been able to leverage that into more units. And just very quickly, for folks who don't know what inclusionary zoning is, basically, you know, when a developer says, you know, I want to turn, you know, this property into 380 units of housing, you're going to say to them, you need to make X percent. In Boston, it's 13%, but, you know, we can come up with whatever makes sense here. But X amount of percent has to be, you know, affordable housing or permanent supportive housing. And if you don't want to do that, then you pay X fee to go into an affordable housing trust fund that will be used to create units in other parts of the city. And so they've raised tens of millions of dollars, created, you know, thousands of new units that would not have been created otherwise. They also, too, you know, commercial developers have to pay, you know, a certain amount per, you know, 100,000 square feet. You know, it gets very specific, right? But we're not advocating for any method, right? Any particular tool. But what we're trying to say is there are a lot of innovative tools out there to put into our toolbox, and let's start talking about doing that now, because even if we were to adopt something today, these units won't be built overnight. So we need to really start talking long term now, because this problem will bubble up again. We've had other tent cities before. Yes, this is the biggest and the most visible, but you know, to Michael's point, we're already starting to see them disperse, and you know, this problem is not going away. It's not going to go away, you know, even if we find shelter for all these folks. There's just, you know, there's 22% of our residents are living in poverty, and that means every single day somebody's, you know, that one paycheck away, that one, you know, car repair away from falling into homelessness and needing services. And so if we don't have a place to relieve the bottleneck in the system, that is the true bottleneck. And we see it at the bridge. You know, we're able to connect, you know, people with housing vouchers. You know, that's, you know, money to use for rent, right? And for every 10 people we do that, only 4 of them are actually able to use them before that they expire. And that is just, that just shows that the supply is not meeting the demand anywhere close to it right now, and the solution to that is creating more supply. And yeah, and developers aren't doing that because there are so many logistical and legal and governmental hoops that you have to jump through to create it, that, you know, they're just, especially the way the housing market is now, we're at over 95% occupancy. You know, why would somebody who's worried about their bottom line and not worried about being compassionate, right, why would they, you know, accept somebody with a voucher over the 10 other people who are lined up behind them who have stable jobs, don't have evictions? You know, we've really got to dig into that long-term solution, because what we're talking about now is, again, addressing the short term. We all want to make sure these folks have a place to go, but it's a misnomer to think that we, you know, as the bridge, feel like, you know, if we just shelter these folks, the problem goes away. That's not true. And we don't want that any more than anybody else does. We're just trying to come up with something that works, you know, for May, right?
Right. And it seems in some ways the initial just immediate need of shelter is the start of the story and not the end for it. So let's talk a little bit about the things that lead to homelessness. I've spent a lot of time at Tent City myself and in other parts of the city talking to homeless people and asking them where they got there, why they got there, rather. And every story, although some of it comes down to one kind of trauma in their life, every story is different. Mm-hmm. So yeah, what are some of the key issues there? I know a lot of them have felonies, and that makes it difficult for them to find a job or housing. Beyond that, what are the problems? Is it poverty? Is it drug use? Is it alcohol use? What is it? Do they want to be homeless?
Of course not. And, I, you know, I've been in this field since, what, early 2004. And I have clearly have been identified as not an expert. And I would concur that I am not an expert on homelessness, but I am most definitely a student of homelessness. And I read a lot of books, and I read studies, and I read the academic journals, and I read so much information to try and be better at my job. And when you ask people in the surveys what made you homeless, they're going to say, I lost a job, I didn't have enough income, and I got evicted. Now, that was probably the result of a series of other things. So you have crisis, you have trauma, you have repeated trauma, probably repeated crises, and you have no more social support. And I talked about this in the State of the Homeless Address. If I suffered a series of these things, I still have a breadth and depth of what we call, you know, social supports, friends, family, distant family. But when you're – and I met a wonderful woman last night, a granny, and I'll just keep her name at that. She's under Tent City. And I said, all right, I told you, what did you – you have a very tiny check on April. What did you do with it? She said, well, I was in the hospital. And I spent my money on my grandbabies because they took care of me while I was in the hospital. I was like, but that was all the money you had. But that was all the money they had. And so when you get into the concept of that, if your social supports are very narrow, if at all existent, or what you do have are also in poverty, it, you know, so people say, well, you know, some folks have family who drive by and see them at I-45. It's because they can't support. The social supports are so thin, and combining with whatever eviction that occurs. Do people have co-occurring disorders, meaning a mental health condition, possibly untreated, or a family didn't know how to treat it and they just finally gave up everything and separated themselves from that person? You see a lot of that. And then The common language, self-medication, whatever, is our access to drugs and cheap drugs. Is that that's part of the vulnerability. I don't know about you all. I had a pretty tough day yesterday. You don't think that after what I went through yesterday at City Council that I didn't go home and sit down and take a deep breath and have a glass of wine with a girlfriend. So, you know what? But it was okay, right? Because I paid for it. It wasn't under I-45 and it was there. So that's just me understanding the human compassion and the humanity that's under there to say that it's not one paycheck away. It could be. But it could be my one benefit check away that I gave to my grandbabies because I needed something. And so the complexity to this problem is just deeper and wider. That's why affordable housing has to be there, because we as a community, we have in effect have become the social network that disappeared. And that's our role. And so everyone's going, whose fault? Well, the most efficient way government was able to do that, the most efficient way was to say if we put all those resources in one place, like the bridge, because we didn't have the money to put 10 bridges, little bridges all over Dallas so that we didn't impact any one neighborhood. That would have been – so we have to find our cost-effective method, and then it has created – well, then that's where the people who continue and growing and fall into this poverty with no social network, that is their social network. That is their social support. And now what we've done, we've overwhelmed the neighborhood. And so now this is where we say, okay, the environment of homelessness has changed. Now we got to rethink the problem. We got to deconstruct everything we're doing and reconstruct it given the new paradigm of no affordable housing, increased urban population, laws that do this, no inclusionary that, source of income discrimination. Now what do we do? And so we're all angry and frustrated. And I heard that yesterday. And I trust that anger is going to help us get to some better solutions.
I think part of that solution, though, is looking at, instead of looking at Dallas, the city of Dallas is trying to solve this problem alone. We need to reach out to the county and even back to the state to try to figure out how do we disperse this solution. Because if you look at the map of where the tents are, putting care and facilities where those tents are or around them might be a useful thing to look at, right? Mm-hmm. Like, instead of having the honeypot that is Tent City here, how do you create those facilities around the places they are? And the problem that you run into is the city council, obviously the people that represent this area are in tune with this already, but there are other council members who don't want this type of visibility in their backyard, right? And you can look at that, and they just yesterday you saw that at the council meeting. But it has to almost not be up to them anymore. Right, we're in such a state right now where we need affordable housing in other districts. There has to be something we can do to help them see that they need to participate.
Well, I would say that many might say that they don't want it visibly in their backyard, but it is in their backyard
already
because
Absolutely. There
are homeless people throughout the city.
Most of them.
So this comes to kind of the final question. We have what we call quality of life ordinances in Dallas, right? You can't sleep in public, you can't urinate in public, panhandling in the downtown corridor is illegal, and although not all panhandlers are homeless, many of them might be. So that boils down to whose quality of life is that protecting? Because in some ways it seems like it criminalizes being homeless. If you can't sleep in public and you don't have a home, where do you sleep? So any of you want to address that issue?
I'd love to address it because it's something that I think is misunderstood about the bridge, that somehow we sanction or don't care about the quality of life violations that are literally happening right outside our facility. They concern us very much. We don't like it for the homeless folks who are there because sometimes they're getting high on K2, stumbling into the middle of the street, it feels like any day now somebody's going to really get hurt. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that. I live downtown too. I don't like having to walk around and feel unsafe. All those are our concerns. But there's just a limited amount of DPD resources that we can tap into. And it's not without us trying. I mean, I have personal relationships with every, major department person at DPD. I think they're a great partner for us. We love them. I think they love us. Me personally, anytime DPD's on site, and as Michael will attest, they're on site a lot, I am quick to go out there and I ask every officer the same thing. I look at them and I'm sincerely, what can the bridge do to help you do your job better? And I'm not suggesting that we're perfect, but I have not gotten any good feedback from that. You know, it's just like, well, you're doing what we're doing. We're trying to do what we're doing. But, you know, we also, too, we hear concerns from the neighbors about, oh, my gosh, there's so many 911 calls at the bridge. Well, a lot of those 911 calls, and I can attest to it because I'm the one calling sometimes, I'm calling to say, hey, there's somebody criminal trespassing across the street. There's somebody asleep across the street. There's somebody high on drugs across the street. So, you know, but you kind of have to pick your criticism there, where it's like either you accept that there's a lot of 911 calls because we're trying to help with that issue, or you just say, hey, stop calling 911. You know, but we don't see that as a viable option because we are always trying to get response from DPD. And I would say really quickly that you know, some of the feedback that I get from DPD, I do sympathize and understand. You know, when I say, hey, you know, you got 10 people here who are literally breaking the law. They're trespassing on private property or whatever they're doing, right? You know, urinating in public, whatever. And they tell me the stories of what it is like for an officer to have to deal with that. And that is taking them down to Lusterd and filling out hours of paperwork, right? Only to get in their car, turn back around, right? And go down that same street and see that same person beat them back. And I'm not saying that means that we don't continue to push and try, but it just shows that there's no easy answer to this, but we're trying really hard.
Yeah. And I would add to that too, the panhandling ordinance was an interesting thing. It kind of came about, well, not the ordinance itself, but the enforcement, the strict enforcement of it came about because the view of the residents of downtown, and I live in the Cedars, so I don't live precisely downtown, but I know almost everyone that's down there that's active, is DPD's policies were built around a resident vacant downtown, right? So the enforcement policies were built around a mostly commercial construct. Now we're approaching 9,000 people downtown. And so that requires, I think, a different view of how to enforce these kinds of things, right? And that was a frustrating moment for them. If you were at the Woolworth during that Crime Watch meeting, I wasn't able to make it there, but there were 200 people in that place voicing a lot of concern about this. So this is kind of an evolutionary question. There is where we were, right, which is 2004. Then we got the bridge. Now we are where we are. How do we, to Cindy's point, assess everything that we have now and move forward with the conversation? I think part of the frustration from the Cedars neighborhood is that we've actually talked to officers who've been told to push people that are sleeping in public south of 30. They don't care where they go, just south of 30. That's DPD telling me that, right? So that conversation, that needs to be addressed. And I think everybody's trying to do what they can. There's no right answer to this. There just needs to be a sense of urgency that I don't think is being felt from anybody to address this thing.
That wouldn't be me.
That wouldn't be you. No. So the mayor yesterday seemed confused, right, by the conversation
absolutely.
That happened there.
Absolutely.
That conversation should have happened 9 months ago and actually been listened to the last time we had it there, right? Mm-hmm. So that just wasn't the case.
There definitely did seem to be a lot of confusion about who has been pushing these efforts and these conversations and who the leadership is. And it was a lot of round of the table, you know, not my problem. So it will be interesting to see in the coming weeks and especially come May how this plays out in the long term, whether there's a real big push for permanent supportive housing and whatnot. So thank you to my guests today, Cindy Crane, Sam Merton, and Michael Sidarzeski. Remember, our show comes out every Thursday, so be sure to join us again next week. We're on iTunes, so subscribe to our channel and tweet us at Texas Crime Cast. And remember to find more on all of our stories today and continuing coverage on DallasNews.com. And thanks to our producer, Tommy Noel. I'm Tasha Chaparis. And now here's Mike Hashimoto with Hashing It Out. Take it away, Mike.
Greg Hardy has never put his hand on any woman. No, sir. Not in his whole entire life. Ask him. Go ahead. ESPN did. At long last, Greg Hardy tries to be clear. He's an innocent man. Hardy confuses innocence with being found not guilty of woman beating because his accuser went into hiding. Photographs of Nicole Holder's head-to-toe bruises tell a different story. Hardy would be just another abusive coward if not for his day job, which is chasing quarterbacks. He last did this for the Dallas Cowboys, probably the only team in the NFL willing to pay him last season. He was far less than advertised. Now Hardy is out of work again. His agent set up the ESPN interview to gin up interest. To say it backfired is unfair to any previous backfires. Instead of expressing even a shred of contrition and promising to do better, and really that's all he had to do, Hardy made things infinitely worse for himself by proclaiming his innocence, no matter what else you may have heard. This is not to say that no NFL team will take a chance on him. It's sad commentary that even the most innocent criminals find their way back if one team is desperate enough. If that team belongs to Jerry Jones, he would deserve every half-empty stadium every Sunday as long as Greg Hardy is on his roster.